Well, first of all, welcome to everybody. It's a pleasure to be back here to the Theosophical Society. I was here, it was last November, right? And we had a wonderful time. And they said, oh, come on back out when you're out in the neighborhood again. We'd love to have you. So here I am again, and it's a great pleasure to be here. I wanted to say a little bit about where I'm going to go with tonight's talk, and then hopefully we can have a little bit of time to be a little bit more interactive. But my goal this evening is to offer you some practical tips and techniques on how to still the mind and how we can enter into that stillness. But before going there, what I wanted to do was I wanted to give you some background, some context in which to understand this power of the stillness that we're talking about. What is it? And how do we enter into it? And why is it important? So I'd like to begin with a quote of a great spiritual master by the name of Kabir. Some of you may have heard of Kabir. Kabir is one of the great spiritual masters of the Indian, of the Asian subcontinent, who is revered throughout South Asia. And interestingly enough, he's revered both as a Hindu and a Muslim. In fact, everybody wants to claim a holy man, right? So, and he has a very powerful quote in one of his Shabads, which actually appears in the Gurbani. And the quote is as follows. It says, with one light, the entire universe came into existence. With that light, all human beings and all creation was brought forth. Who then is good and who then is bad? So it's a very profound statement. And on the surface of it, he's saying that this entire universe, everything in it, has come from one great light. And since we all came from that great light, there is no difference between any of us. There's no good, there's no bad. There's no high, there's no low. That all of us have come from that great light, and we must eventually, in due course, return to that light. So let me give a little context to see, show you where I'm going with this. We talk in all the scriptures, whether it's Hindu or Buddhist or Jain or Sikh, talk about that primordial power we call God as absolute God. Before creation came into existence, there's this absolute nothingness, which is beyond description, apprehension, understanding. It's not a region, it's not a place. There's nothing that can be described other than that power is. And from that primordial oneness, if you will, it is said in different traditions that God was one and wished to be many. And therefore, all creation sprang forth. Different traditions say it in different ways. In the Sufi traditions, they say that God was a hidden treasure and love to be known. So anyways, this from this absolute oneness or absolute God comes a vibration. We call it the primordial vibration. And that vibration manifested itself as divine light and holy sound or celestial sound. And that holy sound, that holy light, that celestial light, that heavenly light, also known as the ringing radiance, is actually referred to in all traditions if we look carefully. Actually, you don't even have to look carefully. It's there on every page of the Guru Granth Sahib. It's throughout the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. It's been called the Word in the Christian tradition. It's been called Nam in the Sikh tradition, or it's been called Shabd or Jyoti, Shruti in the Hindu tradition, The Buddhists have called it the transcendental hearing or the clear light. So the Zoroastrians have called it Zorosha. So this primal power was like the first vibration that came from that absolute. And we call it the God into expression power because it's the first expression of God. And that power creates, maintains, and sustains all creation right down to the tiniest physical atom. So it is the sustaining power that's actually sustaining us as well in this physical body. When that power leaves, we're pronounced dead. Right? So that power we call the Nam, the Shab, the Word, the Jyoti, the Sruti, and I've failed to mention the Sufi tradition, Nur Allah or Nur Muhammadiyah. This is within us. This light is within us and can be contacted. In fact, not only is the light within us, we are drops of the ocean of that great light with our original source back in God. So we are all beings of light. We're all drops in that great ocean of light. But we have lost contact with that primordial power, which is the very sustenance of our life. So all of the great teachers of humanity, all the great masters, the great murshids, the sheikhs, the rebbes, all came to guide humanity back to that light. And we have innumerable references to this in all our different traditions. In fact, my colleague and I have just spent the last 10 years collecting the testimonies, firsthand testimonies of all of the mystics of all traditions. And you would be amazed at how much testimony there is of this inner mystical experience of divine light and sound in all the traditions. Saint after saint in all different traditions speaks of this divine experience. So in a way, the irony of ironies is that it really does not matter what particular school of thought you have joined in order to reach that divine light, so long as you reach that divine light, which is our true self, which is our conscious self, but which we have lost contact with. So let's take it a little step further. So we have this tremendous consciousness within us, but we have lost contact. Why have we lost contact? Because our attention, which is the outer expression of our soul, is constantly engaged through the five senses in all the outer phenomena of life. And that primordial light can only be contacted by closing down the senses, stilling the mind, and entering into meditation where that divine light is already in existence and actually supporting us in this body, moment to moment, nanosecond to nanosecond. But because the force of our conditioning, the force of our habituated and reactive patterns, all direct us outside all the time. We've become living, so to speak, lives that are cut off from the essential self, from this essential light. So what then is meditation? Meditation is the process of reconnecting to your essential conscious self, which is already within you. And the one challenge that we all face is controlling the mind. So the only thing that prevents us from experiencing that divine light on a moment-to-moment basis, we're not just talking about in meditation, is our thoughts. They are the veil, they're the darkness, so to speak, between us and that divine reality which is already hardwired into us. It's already there. So we are beings of love, light, and life. That is our essential nature. That's who we already are. We don't have to create that. We don't have to develop that. We need to unravel what is preventing us from seeing that in our lives. So all suffering, all pain, all unhappiness, all trials and tribulations arise from the lack of connectedness to that divine power within us. In fact, you could say all sin, if you want to use that very moralistic term, which actually has a very non-moral original meaning. Sin simply means to miss the mark. So what is to miss the mark? It's to be looking outside instead of looking inside. So the whole process of meditation then is to still the mind, to eventually control the mind, to eventually get to a state of consciously controlling the mind, so that you think as and when you want to think. How's that for a novel concept, right? You think as and when you want to think because you are a conscious being. Conscious beings have a mind, they are not the mind. Conscious beings have a body, they are not the body. And they know they are a conscious being and therefore have the ability to separate consciousness from both the body and the mind. How do you know someone can do that? Because they can leave the body at will, enter into the stream of consciousness, which is light, which goes all the way back to its source, which is absolute God, through all the various planes of creation, by simply connecting themselves back to that inner light. So this is how human beings have created, and this is the evolutionary journey that we're all on, actually, whether we know it or not. We're all in that process of evolving back into the light, which is our source, and which is who we are, and which, by the way, we have to go back to because we can't stay in this body. So we all know we're all going to get the eviction notice. Some are going to get it very soon, some a little later, but we're all getting it. And we don't know when the eviction notice is coming. A conscious being has absolutely nothing to fear about death because they know death is simply dropping the body and entering into more beautiful, higher, more loving, more insightful, more permanent, more joyous, more ecstatic states of existence. The fear exists within us because we have not traversed, we have not taken that journey out of the body. So what then is meditation? When we say the power of stillness, what is the power of stillness? It's the power of entering into your conscious self, which is beyond mind, beyond matter, and beyond illusion. So what is our normal state? Because let's get back to reality. So that's your kind of broad context, right? So let's get back to reality where we really are, right? What do we experience? On a day-to-day basis, we experience the opposite of stillness. And let's just say, in most cases, the extreme opposite of stillness on a variety of very unholy, unhealthy ways. So what does that manifest as? It manifests as what we call, the Buddhists call it, the five unskillful actions. And these five unskillful actions become habituated, conditioned, and reactive. And by the way, neuroscience is now beginning to support, all right, this is a very interesting recent discovery of neuroscience, the difference between brain and mind, okay? And I want to go into that in a little bit more. So anyways, these five unskillful actions we mostly can recognize as the following: hurry and worry, agitation and restlessness, doubt and uncertainty, fear and anxiety, depression. Okay, so these states of awareness are the result of not being in our essential self, which is conscious and still and free from mental oscillations. Okay? So let me give you a couple of analogies to help paint the picture, because we also have to understand what mind is. So if we are conscious beings created from this ocean of all consciousness, that we are drops of that great ocean of all consciousness, and therefore we partake of the same essence of that consciousness, and those attributes are love, light, and life. So you are eternal beings. Stuck, prisoned house, or you could say ensouled in this body, which is a temporary location for it. Cannot stay here long. Consciousness is permanent, it cannot dissolve, it cannot be diluted, and it cannot be changed, just like God. So as we come into this physical body, we begin to experience those conditioned, habituated, and reactive patterns because of the power of thought. And this is where we have to dig very deep to understand our current situation. So thought is incredibly powerful, much more powerful than word or deed. And in fact, we do not realize how much of our lives are the result of our thinking patterns. So again, going back to the Buddhist tradition, in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, everything that you are is the result of our thinking. Everything that we are is the result of our thinking. My own great spiritual master used to say that as you think, so you become. As you think, so you become. So the first step in this journey back to your essential conscious state has got to be to get to that place of controlling the mind. And the first step in that process is replacing all of the negative thought patterns with positive ones. And the reason, which is not a big esoteric secret, is that the negative thought patterns are much harder to control, whereas the positive ones are very easily controlled and very consciously enacted, right? So we want to get to that state where, which is another, so to speak, definition of meditation, where we think what we want to think when we want to think it, forget what we want to forget when we want to forget it. And that's a state, a meditative state of consciousness. And that's the place we want to be. That's where we want to get to. So a little bit of background to understand why thought is so powerful. So it's said that God doesn't create any heaven or hell for any of us. We've already done that for ourselves right now. And we are all living in the self-created heavens and hells that are the result of our thinking. All states of happiness or sadness, gratitude, ingratitude, equanimity, peace, joy, happiness, all of those are a result of your habituated, reactive, conditioned thinking. So whatever states that we are in right now on a daily basis are entirely our own creation. And this is very important to understand, because that is incredibly empowering. And it's incredibly empowering because we know that we actually can change that then. That we do not have to accept or be resigned to the mental or emotional states that we currently find ourselves in. That they can all be changed through the power of our thoughts. And the process that will allow us to get control of the mind is this process of meditation. So as we connect back to this divine light, to this holy sound, this celestial music, which is reverberating within us all the time, it immediately puts us in a state of quietness. And the mind stops. It completely quiets the mind. And in that state of silence and stillness, we experience our innate natural joy, the innate natural bliss. And the word happiness really is not a good word, because happiness kind of connotes unhappiness. But the innate state of the soul is perpetual bliss, if you will. It's perpetual ecstasy. That is its natural place. So by removing the thoughts, controlling the mind, we simply enter into that state effortlessly and naturally, and we stay there. There's no reason why we shouldn't. It's where we belong. It's where we have come from. It's where we have arisen from. So the trick is how to begin that process. And that's where the practice of meditation comes. So my own spiritual master, when I was in India one time, and I've been to India many, many times and have had the great, tremendous blessing of studying with three great, truly amazing beings of light. And in those many trips to India and many opportunities to learn from them, one of the things that my master said that shocked me at first, this was many, many years ago, he said that you are all micro-gods. You're all micro-gods. He said, if God can create the entire universe, can't you create at least one small town? And so people will be kind of wondering, what is he talking about? What do you mean, create one small town? And people ask him, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, if God has had the power to create this entire universe, and you are a micro-god, you're a part of God, then shouldn't you be able to, on a small scale, at least create a little town somewhere? I mean, manifest the entire town? And of course we can. You know, we read in the scriptures about the power of the soul, but we have lost faith in the scriptures and in our own essential self. So when Jesus says, if ye have faith, ye shall move mountains, he's not joking around. He's very serious. In the same way that my spiritual master said, you can create a town, well, you can move mountains, you can do much more than that. How is that done? Through the power of attention in which mind is fully controlled. In which the mind is under your power and not you under the mind. And that is the difference. Right now, our condition could be described as the following. There's a teacher whose name was Mulla. Some of you may have heard of Mulla Nasruddin. He was a Turkish teacher. The word Mulla simply means teacher. And Mulla was well respected in the town, and one day he was on his horse. In those days, that was the typical mode of travel. And he's trotting down the road with his horse. And all of a sudden, the horse sees a snake in front of its path, and it gets spooked, and it rears up, and it starts to run at full speed. So Mulla is holding on to the reins, but in fact, he has no control of the horse. He's completely out of control. And he's crossing an intersection. One of his close friends, old buddy, sees him going at this absolutely ridiculous speed and calls out to him and says, Mula, where could you be going at such a ridiculous speed? And Mula, holding onto the reins for dear life, says, don't ask me, ask my horse. And this is how we feel in our life. We feel like we're kind of moving at such a fast speed, but we're completely out of control. We have no control over the directions. The reason we experience that is because of the nature of the habituated, controlled, and continuous thinking patterns that we cannot stop. So instead of basking in the illumination of our essential self, we are in states of constant thinking 99.9% of the day. And this is the problem. So let me give you an example. Let's a little mathematics here for us. There are approximately 23,300 out-breaths and the same number of in-breaths. So 46,600 approximately in-breaths and out-breaths per day, on an average, if you're not running the marathon, right? In a conscious state, meaning awake. And in every in-breath and out-breath, you can have at least a thought, if not many more, because thought is so fast, so rapid, that in an in-breath or an in-breath, you could have five thoughts. So on at least on a conservative basis, we have 60, 70,000 thoughts per day. So everyone's thinking for a second, wait a second. I'm not aware of those 60 to 70,000 thoughts per day. Aha, there's the rub. That's the whole point, we're not. But those thoughts, nevertheless, are going on all the time in these tape loops. And the tape loops, we've already mentioned, agitation and restlessness, hurry and worry, regret, fear, anxiety, depression, and they keep going on. And they're like when you boot up a computer, and you boot up the computer, what happens? All of the software that's already been installed boots up with it, doesn't it? And runs automatically the minute you boot up your computer. Well, this is exactly what has happened to us. So over eons of lifetimes, we've developed tendencies, and we call them seeds or impressions. Another term for them is karma. Karma is any thought, word, or deed, and it's going to create an action and a reaction. So every thought, word, and deed has an action, and therefore a reaction will come back to it. Basic law of thermodynamics. You can't get escape from that. As you sow, so shall you reap. So let's just put the picture together so we understand the difficulty that we are dealing with, but at the same time, the importance. So if you're thinking 60 to 70, 80,000 thoughts per day, and we're not aware of hardly any of them, right? So what is the effect of those thoughts upon us that is happening whether we are conscious of those thoughts or not? Doesn't matter if you're conscious of them or not. So here's the deal. For every good thought that brings joy or happiness to others or ourselves, that thought goes out to the universe, goes out, radiates out, because thoughts are things, we'll talk more about that, and resonates with the thoughts that are similar in nature and then comes right back to you as a gift, seven more of the same kind. On the other hand, any thoughts that are bringing pain or suffering to us or to others, whether it's carelessness or inattention or lack of gratitude or bitterness or jealousy or, God forbid, criticism and hatred and unforgiveness, all of those thoughts do the same thing. They go out there, resonate with all of those other fields of thoughts that are similar to it, come back and place a little package on us. That's why we're in the states of consciousness that we are. And there is only one, if you will, way out, and that is the way in. And that's why all the great spiritual traditions, you can look at any tradition, all talk about the core practice of our spiritual path as meditation, which is different than prayer. Because prayer involves the mind and is a form of petitioning, whereas meditation is about reversing the flow of attention from outside to inside, reconnecting to that divine essence of light which is within us. Once we're reconnected, developing conscious control of the thinking and thought patterns, which right now sounds like almost an absurdity to us, like that could actually happen, right? And then the gradual ability to withdraw consciousness from the physical body and leave at will, which is why we say in many traditions that meditation is the art of learning to die so that you can begin to live. So that's the challenge that we're in. Let's add a few more pieces to the puzzle so that you can get a sense of why meditation is so important, if we're going to come out of the dream that we are in. And it is a dream. Every thought is a thing. It's more powerful than words and deeds. And there's an interesting story told in the Eastern tradition about Akbar and his minister Birbal. Akbar was a great, as you know, Mughal minister. He was emperor. And he had a very wise and very intelligent minister who was trying to help him run his kingdom in a more efficient, orderly way. And so one day he comes up to Akbar and he says, "Listen, do you know the importance of thought, how powerful thought is?" And he says, "Thought is more powerful than word and deed." And Akbar says, "No, how can that be? How can a thought be more powerful than physical action or physical word?" He said, "Okay, well, let's have a little experiment." It's like a thought experiment. So he says, "Let's go out to a hill," and they take him out to a hill, and he says, "Look down the distance, and you can see that there's a man approaching you at a distance of 300-400 yards. And what I want you to do is I want you to think evil of that person. Think abusive thoughts of that person, hurtful thoughts. And when he comes here, let's ask him a few questions." So Akbar, following in the experiment, starts to send very evil, negative thoughts, abusive thoughts, angry thoughts to this person. And when the person arises and comes to the top of the hill, Akbar says to him, "Listen, tell me the truth. What were you thinking when you actually saw me?" And says, since he knows he's the emperor, right? He says, "Whatever you say will not be held against you, but just tell me the truth." So at first the guy says, "Oh no, emperor, when I saw you, I was just filled with joy and happiness, and you're my emperor and I love you and all that." He said, No. I know that can't be what you were thinking. What? Tell us the truth." He says, so he thinks for a minute, he says, he realizes he wants the truth. So he says, "To tell you the truth, the minute I saw your face, I felt like hitting you. I felt like retaliating. I felt like abusing you physically and verbally." So we don't realize that these thoughts that we send out are very, very powerful. And we don't realize how much power we have. And it is these thought forms that are circulating all over this universe that are actually creating the reality that you see around us. Let me take it even a step further. There are individual karmas. There are family karmas. There are community karmas. There are religious karmas. There are national karmas. And wherever you reside, you will have the effect of all of those in your lifetime. So if you happen to be living in a place like Syria, you're going to be experiencing the national karma that country has to go through. Or if you're living in India, in Delhi, or anywhere else. So every location, every region, even ethnicities all have their individual and national and specific karmas. And those things are things that we have to experience because of what we have done in the past. Those reactions are coming back to us. So we see that it's a very complicated process. The good news is that as we awaken to this divine reality within us, as we begin to identify with the essential self, which is who we are, which is love personified, we begin to develop unconditional love for everyone and everything, because that's our essential nature. And even if someone is sending us negative thoughts, even if someone is sending us hateful thoughts or angry thoughts or bitter thoughts or whatever they're sending us, because we are rooted in our essential self, we return not evil for evil, but good for evil. And this is how we protect ourselves. And this is how we bring joy and peace into environments that may be very, very negative. So, you know, many people, we talk about, and I do a lot of workshops around working on our daily realities. The person you can't get along with, right? The difficult boss, the financial problems and anxiety that come with, you know, challenging financial circumstances and all of the rest, right? How do we get out of those circumstances? How do we change that reality? And we can only change that reality by entering into that stillness and becoming more conscious of who we are. On a day-to-day, moment-to-moment, nanosecond-to-nanosecond process. And as we do that, we become naturally embedded in that divine light, and that light's natural characteristics automatically manifest. So I was talking the other day with someone, and this is like a typical conversation you have with people. But I want to show you an illustration where someone is saying, look, you know, they have a very difficult situation with this particular person, and whenever around this person pushes all their buttons, and they get into these, what we call automatic thinking. They just see that person and it triggers all of these emotional reactions, or it triggers all these responses, because it's conditioned, habituated, and reactive, right? It's not conscious. So we're really not conscious beings. And in fact, actually, the interesting neuroscience to that was, did a study recently, they found out that most of us go through the day with 92% of the decisions we make are pretty unconscious. We're just going through like robots, mechanically going through their day. And if you become very conscious and you look at people, you'll notice that even their mannerisms, even the way they say hello, even the way they say goodbye, there's a mechanicalness, there's a roboticness to it. If you get into that place where you're very slow and you're very quiet, you can see that everybody is acting in a very mechanical, robotic way. They're not alive. They're not present. So in the same way, those thoughts are just going on and on and on and on. So the story is this. In dealing with this particular person, because we have to understand that we need compassion for the situation. We have to have compassion for ourselves first. There's a story in a Buddhist tradition about a Buddhist who had taken a vow, and you know that many Buddhists take a vow to protect and save all sentient life. And so this particular sage was walking down a riverbank, and he sees a tarantula that has been swept into this river. And that tarantula is drowning. It's going to drown. So because of his vow to save all sentient beings, he jumps in the river, swims out to save the tarantula. And as soon as he grabs the tarantula responds by biting him. And he's a little shocked because here he is trying to save the life of this poor insect. He's risking his own life to save. And the tarantula bites. And he said, why did you do that? And there's no response. He lets the tarantula go for a second because of the pain in his hand. And then he realizes his vow. And he goes further down the river to swim and catch the tarantula again. He grabs hold of the tarantula a second time. The tarantula does the same thing a second time. And the process repeats itself on a third time. So finally, you know, in these stories, they always have the animals always talk. So Don't ask me why that's the case, but they, always the animals are talking. Anyways, this animal, this tarantula, talks back. He says, listen, you know, he asks him a question. He says, listen, I've been trying to save you. You've bitten me 3 times in a row. Don't you realize you're going to drown if you don't allow me to save you? Here I am trying to save you. I'm going to bring you to shore. You can live. And you're preventing me from actually saving you. That doesn't make any sense. And so the tarantula replies back. The tarantula says, I understand that. And he says, but I have a question for you. He says, you, knowing after the first time that I bit you, knowing after the second time that I bit you, why did you keep coming to me on the third time to save me, knowing that each time you risked your own life? So going back to the original question, the tarantula says, to answer your question, and then you answer my question. So he says, well, why did you bite me? And he says, well, that's what tarantulas do. I'm a tarantula. I bite people. And so the monk thought for a minute, and he said, to answer your question, I have a monk who has taken a vow to save all sentient beings. That's what I do. That's who I am. So the meaning here should be pretty transparent. We act in accordance with who we think we are. If we believe that we are limited, angry, deceitful, hypocritical beings, that's what we become. If you believe, to start with, that you are a drop of the ocean of all consciousness, you are beings of light, that your natural state is unconditional love, illumination, and happiness, you will act according to that state. Because it's who you are. You can't act in any other way because it is who you are. So, another example. The sun shines on everyone. The sun doesn't really care what color your skin is, what town you live in, whether there's clouds or rain. The sun does what the sun does. It shines. You are soul. You are, and my own master said, that your light is equal to 16 outer suns. Wow. We are brilliant beings. We are divine beings. Did anyone ever tell you that? Did anyone ever say that you have the luminosity of 16 outer suns? That your essential nature is nothing but unconditional love? That's how Jesus, when he was on the cross and they're nailing him up there and the blood is pouring out, says, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. He didn't say, I'll get back at you next lifetime. Are you getting this? This is who we are, but we have forgotten who we are. We have become mind, we become the image of mind, and we become in the image of body. And all problems, all suffering, all challenges that we have in our lives with relationships and everything else arise from that fantastic, incredible identity crisis. The minute we enter into the divine reality of light, we start to get control of the mind and enter into the divine stillness. What does the Bible says? Be still and know that you are God. That divine reality begins to dawn on us. So such is the power of that stillness. So here's the math that I wanted to leave you with, my own spiritual master. Try to summarize everything. He said, God plus mind equals human being. Human being minus mind equals God. There you go. That's who you are when you get control of this thing. Now, here's the interesting thing. There are many levels to mind. We have a physical mind, We have an astral mind. We have a causal mind. We have a supercausal mind. And it's not till you go beyond supercausal that you see yourself as pure consciousness. That's the journey. So we need to pass through this process and going through it. And each level of mind becomes more and more subtle and more refined. But mind is not conscious. It's a vehicle of consciousness. So now I want to show you, I want to give you a kind of an analogy of how meditation works. Okay? What's the analogy that will help us conceptualize what's really happening in the meditative state? And then let's sit for meditation, because that's the best thing. You can fit everything I said completely. Most of us do anyways. But the connection within will last. So there's a story that Jalaluddin Rumi, one of the great, great Sufi saints, says to try to understand how meditation works and how this mind is working. How does it work? So he talks about an annual contest that was held between the Chinese and the Greek painters way back. So instead of basketball and baseball, the entertainment was painting, I guess. So once a year, they would bring the best painters from the Greeks they had and the best painters that the Chinese had, and they would put them in a room. And on either side, there would be a wall, and they'd put a curtain in the middle of the room. So on either side was a marble wall, and they had 3 days, the painters, to create the most beautiful painting they possibly could. And after 3 days, the judges would decide which painting was the best, and they would receive for their efforts a tremendous reward and acknowledgement and praise. So they divide up the room, they put the curtain up, the Greeks go to work, and the Chinese go to work. And the first day, the Greeks pull out their Brillo, and they start scrubbing the wall, start cleaning. And the first day, the Chinese are pulling out the paints, and they're painting at such a furious pace, it's just hard, so fast you can't even see their hands moving. Second day comes. Meanwhile, the Greeks are still just cleaning the wall. Nothing. They hadn't picked up a brush. They haven't mixed any paint. They haven't done anything except clean. Meanwhile, the Greeks, the Chinese have created this incredible mural. It's like you could step into it. It's like three-dimensional. It's like the greatest art the world has ever seen. It's just so real that you, if you didn't know it was a painting, you'd walk through it. That kind of incredible art. So the third day comes, all the kingdom is invited, they're going to drop the veil, they're going to see who has painted the most amazing picture. The veil drops, and everybody's attention immediately goes to the Chinese side. And they see this incredible mural. It's just so beautiful, so magnificent, so perfect in its detail. Then, to their absolute shock and amazement, they look to the other side, where the Greeks were, and they see the exact same painting as on the Greek side, on the Chinese side, in exactly the same proportions, everything. Only it was even better, because there were no brushstrokes. So what had happened was they had polished the wall so perfectly that it had become a mirror, and it was now reflecting the Chinese painting on the opposite side. And it was even better because it had the quality of luminosity, the way a mirror can reflect light, right? And the same, you look in the mirror, but there's also a luminosity to it. And there were no brush strokes. So it had no tinge of even looking like a painting. And naturally, they won. So this is actually the slow process that happens in meditation. Every day we sit. What we are doing is polishing the mirror of our minds. So the mind is like a mirror. And right now that mirror is filled with with thoughts. So to use the analogy, make it more descriptive, imagine every thought is like a piece of dirt or a tiny piece of mud. So every time you throw another piece of mud on that mirror, eventually it's nothing but mud. It's not reflecting anything, is it? It's just one big mud pie, right? Of continual thoughts. So the luminosity, it can't reflect any luminosity because it has no reflective ability, does it? Start pulling off one hunk of mud at a time, little tiny piece, and all of a sudden there's a little bit of reflectivity, right? And as that reflectivity increases, what is it going to reflect? It will reflect what it already is, which is the innate, divine, luminous consciousness, which is who you are. So every time we pull one thought away, disidentify with a thought or with an emotion, we're pulling off that cakes and eons of mud on this divine mirror of luminosity. And after many years of practice, what happens? All of a sudden, we begin to see brilliance. Brilliance upon brilliance. And as that divine light enters us, as the divine light will begin to transform us, we begin to identify with its essential characteristics. We have to act in accordance with the divine light. Then we become the conscious co-creators of that divine plan, using light as your divine tool. And by using light, see, we're not going to just become luminous beings. We're going to use the light to heal ourselves and to heal others. And someone who has developed their consciousness, if they simply look at you and send that light to you, they can heal you completely if they choose to, and if it's within divine will. So we're going to become conscious co-workers of this divine light, and we're going to use this light as conscious light in every single way and in every single place to bring joy and happiness and relieve suffering and pain in the universe. That's the healing we all took birth for, whether we know it or not. That's the healing we all took birth for. So all of that mud has to go one day. And it will go. And the only thing that keeps us from getting there quicker is what I call won't power. You've heard of willpower? Well, this is, we also have a thing called won't power. So won't power are the habits that have become entrenched, which are very hard to break. And that's where the sitting and the practice begins to unravel and take them apart one by one. And that's the process. So what I'd like to do is sit and do some polishing. That's the real good that we can do ourselves. And then at the end, if we can have a more interactive session, we can talk a little bit about some tips in terms of beginning your practice, if you're already meditators, how to improve that practice, go deeper into that practice. Eventually, our goal is never to leave that light. We want to be instruments of that light. We want to be conscious co-creators with that light. All right? Let's not forget what the great masters have said, like Jesus. He said, whoever comes to me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. This is what the masters have said. You look at all the traditions. This is what they've said, right? So allow me to just lead you in a very simple practice that for about 15 minutes. Will that be all right? Okay. So after I just give some simple directions, we can just cut down the lights so that we can, in a few minutes, yeah. Just, you don't need any light on me. So this is a very, very simple practice. And what I love about meditation is that no philosophy required. A child of 5 years old can do this, or a centenarian. You don't need any special physical postures. You don't need any philosophy. You don't need any PhD. You don't need anything except an innate longing to know who we are. So you're going to get into a position where you can sit comfortably for about 10 minutes. And take a minute to get yourself nice and comfortable. Your back should be straight but not rigid. You want to take a moment and just close your eyes very gently as if you're going to sleep, but you're not going to go to sleep. You're going to remain awake. And as your eyes are closed, I want you to just take a moment and relax any tensions you may feel in the body, particularly around the face, the forehead, the neck, the shoulders, any of these areas. We hold a lot of tension, and tension prevents us from concentrating. So you want to take a few minutes, if you need to, take a few deep breaths. Inhale and exhale, just relax, let those shoulders down, release that belly. Get into that place where you're not fighting gravity, where you can feel yourself sinking into the chair, but you're not collapsing. You're just, all of a sudden, you can feel that you've let go a little bit. You're still erect. So this first step is just deep relaxation. And the second step is what we've been talking about the whole evening here, which is entering into that stillness, quieting the mind. So you're going to look into the center of the field of awareness lying directly in front of you. And you're going to look not at the tiny pinpricker in the middle, but just a general area within the center. We call that the field of consciousness. We call that the screen of awareness, if you will. This is the place where we begin this reconnection process, right? So you're going to look, just look, gazing steadily, penetratingly into the center to see what is in front of you. And in order to help that process, I want you to repeat any name of divinity or any name of God or anything that represents your aspiration for coming here tonight. So it could be love, unity, peace, gratitude, or any name of any holy being that you find inspires you, brings you to that place of recollection. And just repeat that name very slowly or at intervals, but not so fast so that it disturbs your gaze. So it's the looking. And Jesus called this the knocking, knocking on that inner door. So you can turn the rest of the lights off. And as you are, okay, fine. As you are looking into that field of darkness, if any thoughts do come up, and they will, I want you to just do not judge them, do not analyze them, do not critique them. Let them come and go, and just keep bringing your attention back to that point of focus, right? Doesn't matter if they're good thoughts or bad thoughts, you will notice them, you'll let them go. You're disidentifying with that thoughts and entering into that stream of awareness. It is moment-to-moment consciousness. And if, through the grace of God, you begin to experience or you see the opening of your eye, your third eye, your spiritual eye, and any form of illumination begins to come, whether it's a pinprick of light or whether a sudden burst of color or whether spiritual vistas appear or whatever forms of illumination, even if it's just not complete darkness, but just maybe clouds passing, I want you to enter into that, merge into that like a ray of light returning to the sun, like a drop returning to the ocean, dissolving, boundaryless awareness. Okay? So we pray to the Divine Beloved for in whom is present in all of us to give us whatever is in our best interests. And let us sit. And I'll bring you out with the sound of my voice. Let us begin.
For the meditation, please pause your player for approximately 15 minutes and then resume playback.
Please leave off, and if you could just raise those lights. And as the lights come on, just take a minute to slowly bring your awareness back to your physical surroundings. And as you open your eyes, hold the stillness, hold the quiet, hold the awareness. So the goal as you're coming out of the meditation is to be aware of that state that you were in, and now try to bring that energy into your daily life so that we're just a little bit more conscious, a little bit more aware of our thought patterns, of what's going on. The goal is to be mindful in the moment. And mindfulness can be described as moment-to-moment awareness without judgment. And not talking about judgment here in the sense of assessing something, but judgment in the sense of criticizing or critiquing in a negative way, right? So you're coming into that field of awareness, you're bringing that concentrated attention into the present moment. And with that concentration, and there have been many, many, many studies on many levels, you'll have better memory. You'll start connecting to intuition, which is the higher functioning of the mind on the inner planes. Start to get thoughts without thinking. And as Emerson says, the thoughts that come without thinking are always perfect because you're channeling from a higher source, right? So the habituated reactive patterns start to lessen because you're conscious in the moment. We're not, and we're listening to the thought patterns as they arise, right? Typically, what happens is we'll have an angry thought, identify with it. Typically, after the meditation process happens, we say, that was an angry thought. That's not me. So you begin the disidentification process. One thought at a time, one holy thought at a time. And that is the journey. So a couple of things, and then we can open up to questions on any level. What I found over 42, 43 years of meditating is that in the beginning stages, 15 or 20 minutes sounds like a lot. But through guidance, through proper guidance, through right practice, and through spiritual community, three pillars of our spiritual life, we will run to our meditations. Like you've never run to anything before in your whole existence. And why would we want to? Because what we're experiencing is who we really are. Once we've tasted our original state, once we've tasted that stillness, we've tasted that exquisite beauty of the moment, what it means to be in the moment, you don't want to be anywhere else. You don't want to be regretting the past and fearing the future. You don't want to be in those tape loops of anxiety and depression. You don't want to be in those tape loops of fear of the future or financial issues. You want to be out of that. Those are all mini prisons, prison houses. They're little miniature prison houses that we carry around with us every single day and that we actually locked ourselves in and threw the key away. So meditation is about freedom. It's about awareness building. It's about increasing consciousness. And with an increase of consciousness comes the one permanent, everlasting quality for which we have been created, and that is love. The one permanent, everlasting quality for which we have been created. So, questions, comments, answers. Yeah.
Please wait for the mic.
Thank you. That's wonderful. First of all, thank you. And meditate anytime, morning, noon, night, doesn't matter. I read that if you meditate at night before you go to bed, you start connecting with other planes and yep. Can keep you awake, et cetera, et cetera.
Which you should be. let me just say something. A lot of times, and by the way, I will be doing a workshop and a sitting on Saturday for those of you who want to come. There's a retreat here. You can mention more about it. Mm-hmm. The big mistake we all make, because this is about identity issues. Remember I said we're in a huge identity crisis. Why do we fear anything? Because we're attached to the body. That's the primal fear. We're attached to the body. When your attachment to the body goes, there's no more fears because you know your existence continues. But here's the big mistake we all make. Meditation is not, and I repeat, not what you do 15 or 20 minutes or half an hour or 2 hours a day or whatever. It's what you're doing the other 23 hours of the day and 40 minutes. Are you getting that? Because that's the issue. It is consciousness that we are increasing. Meditation is about raising awareness throughout your whole day. That's what it's about. So, and it is about open-eyed meditation. You don't have to close your eyes. The closing the eyes is simply because the manifestations of divine light are very minuscule in the beginning. When the manifestations of a divine light become strong, 16 outer suns sounds pretty bright to me. Right? You'll be walking down the street. They talk about mystics, and they say the mystics see the light of the noonday sun with their eyes open and at midnight. That's what they're talking about. These are the mystical experiences. Read the text. They're all over the place. You want 1,000 references to those experiences? I'll give you it. I have them. We have them. The research has been done. So it's not about the 20 minutes. What are you going to do the other 23 hours? That's your meditation practice. When you sit, it's just to recapture and go deeper. You want to bring that light into manifestation. I said, that's what we're all about. We are beings of light. Bring your beingness into manifestation. Bring your love into manifestation. So I was saying, some people say, be here now. Yes, be here now is one thing. Be happy now, one more step. Be love now. Be here now. Be happy now. Be love now. That's the essence of meditation. Okay? In a state of love all the time. In a state of love. We're not talking about lust. We're not talking about attachment. We're not talking about infatuation. Okay? Love. Unconditional love. That means someone yells at you and they scream at you and they abuse you and they persecute you, and what do? You give them two for one. Every time they abuse you, give them two more good deeds. Now that's a state of love. See, this is very different than the way people conceptualize meditation. Right? We are conscious beings. The food of consciousness is light. And that's how we sustain ourselves on this planet. And the reason we're all messed up, because we haven't been eating properly. Food of the mind is intellectuality. Food of the body is material sustenance. But did you know that if you get enough inner light, you don't need either of the other two? You can live without any food. Yeah. You don't have to. You can eat because you've got routines. It's nice, tasty, but you don't need it. The light provides all physical, mental nourishment that this body actually needs. And there are many, many cases of that. So, you are the light. Just stay in touch with it, wherever you are. Any other questions? Comments? Yeah.
You made a statement.
Just a second, Diane.
Thank you for a wonderful...
I would say thank my spiritual masters and God Almighty if you got anything good. And I'll take credit for all the errors and mistakes.
I think what I heard you say was you said God plus the mind equals the human being.
Right.
And then minus the mind is God.
Right. Human beings minus mind equals God.
Right, exactly. I was wondering if you might elaborate a little bit on that.
This is a simple equation. The only thing that stands between us and the divine reality of our oneness with God is the mind. It's the mind that is kind of besmearing everything. And the mind actually was intended to be a vehicle for consciousness. But because it has, through its association with the body and outward enjoyments and the five senses, it has taken all the impressions from all these past lifetimes, and that has been the reservoir of our subconscious. So all of these thought forms are just circulating, circulating, circulating. So we have become the image of those thoughts. So the minute you get rid of that, the minute you go beyond that, what lies beyond that is God. So the whole journey is eliminating. It's not eliminating mind, it's controlling mind. And now you're going to use the mind in its highest, for its highest purpose. But it's a step-by-step process. So it's not all of a sudden you're going to wake up and you have no thoughts anymore. No, not going to happen. What's going to happen is every day, as we develop more and more consciousness, right, thoughts come under our control, right? Awareness becomes greater and greater and greater. And the sign of that awareness, the sign that we are growing in awareness, is that experience of love. That's how we know we're growing in that awareness. Love is beyond duality. Love is beyond time. Love is beyond causation. Love is our original state. It's the original state from which God created everything. And in understanding ourselves in our deepest sense, we then understand God. And the one thing that prevents us is this veil of the mind. And they talk about four components of mind really quickly. One is ego, the other is intellect, the other is what we call memory, and the third is what we call perception. All those four things work together, all right? But the hardest one is what I've touched on at all, and that's ego. And ego can be defined as our identification with our thoughts, words, and deeds as who we are. So we're identified with those thoughts as who we are. And so when we lose our job, what happens? We get upset. We're identified. We think we are our job. We think we are our career, right? When we're identified with a role, like I'm a mother, and all of a sudden our children grow up, what happens? Right? Where we're identified with the body as who we are, what happens when you have no more body? Right? So these are all false identifications that we have the collective term, not from a Freudian sense, from an Eastern sense. That collective identification with the mind and body is ego. And ego is what separates us from God, from our source. That's the separation. That's what creates the illusion of duality, all those things. So we have so many identifications, so many, as roles, as you know, our roles, our age, our gender, our ethnicity, our religion, our, you name it. It just goes on and on and on. Each one of those is a form of illusion. You're not a woman, I'm not a man. You're a soul, you're a conscious being, but we're identified with this body. We have been male, we have been female. We have been animal, we have been bird, we have been insect, we have maybe been angels. We have lived on other planets, we have been different solar systems. This whole universe has each planet in the universe. One time we were with our spiritual master and someone asked him, he said, well, what about all these other universes and all these other planets? So what are they all for? And he said, every planet in the solar system has a divine evolutionary purpose. And there are beings on all of these planets. We just haven't found them yet because we think they're going to look like us. So this Earth plane is just one particular place of evolutionary work that's going on this planet, There are universes within the astral plane and universes upon universes within the causal plane. So we've got an amazing universe that you know God has created, and we're living in this tiny kind of like frog in the well mentality. We gotta wake up. Yeah.
Maybe a final question from the audience watching from home.
From home, good.
Yes, Larry asks, so much of what I read about spiritual growth speaks about being detached and non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. How can a person quiet personal attachment to being judgmental?
How can they learn to be detached from being judgmental? Okay, that is a wonderful question, because it is judgment that begins the process of separating ourselves from others. The minute we see ourselves as different and separate, either inferior or superior, we are in the realm of ignorance. And it is those kinds of separations that prevent us from experiencing that divine inheritance of love. But what you start with is this. Let's say, and there are three main areas where we begin to differentiate. We have thoughts of judgment. Pride of position, pride of wealth, pride of knowledge, generally speaking. And so we need to be aware of how we are perceiving others because of their dress, because of their intellect, how they speak, and so on and so forth. All of that is illusion. So as we're going through our day, what we recommend from this point of view, the spiritual tradition I belong to, is to analyze at the end of every day, and there's a scientific process of doing this, each thought, categorizing it, understanding it, and like a gardener pulling out weeds, disidentify. So you notice the thought, you notice the circumstance in which the thought arises, you notice your reaction in those circumstances, right?